Hi, welcome everyone. And we've taken a short break from Heritage Matters webinars because we completed 10 webinars. And what we did was an evaluation to see how we're going and what are some of the suggestions. And thanks to all of you who have taken the time out either to call me, send WhatsApp messages, and or actually fill in the survey form. It's really much appreciated. And we have had in the first 10 webinars over 5,300 participants, 45 panelists, and mostly architects and designers who are very interdisciplinary, who very much grounded in contemporary realities. And our participants came from, and including the panelists, from 129 countries. So it's been a global feature. And Heritage Matters webinars is a genuine seminar on the web. So we usually have three panelists, and each panelist comes up with 3 to 4 ideas in a span of about 8 minutes. And then we have 1 hour of discussion. And the idea of it is that we need to think of seminal ideas. Why do we need to think of seminal ideas? Well, you know it better than me, in different parts of the world where you come from, that the triangulation of COVID-19, climate crisis, and the continuing gross inequities, as reflected in Black Lives Matter, in India, Dalit Lives Matter, in Australia, Black Lives Matter, around the world, the whole question of inequities has surfaced. Given the lockdown. So all these form the challenge for launching Heritage Matter webinar series. We conceptualized it in March this year, and we launched it on the 18th, the series on the 18th of April. And we have had continuous support and interest and very engaging participants and panelists. But what is our conviction? Our conviction is that the underlying conviction is that heritage, irrespective of its manifestation, is critical to, for our resilience to build post-pandemic futures. I use the word futures plural, just like when people say normal, I say no, there are multiple normalities that we'll have to deal with, whatever they are. This resilience is the very ethos of sustainable development. And that's exactly what we're going to address here. But before I go on to this particular webinar, I once again appeal to people not to use the expression social distancing, because social distancing for those of us from the global south, but also people in the global north who belong to culturally and linguistically diverse groups, it means basically discrimination, whether it's caste system. In India, it's racism. In Australia or United States, social distancing is something that we all know about. It's historically practiced as a form of discrimination. So what we're really talking about, physical distancing. Hope you're all, taking care and keeping well. And now we move on to this webinar, which is called Writing Architecture, where we will interrogate the extent to which writing on architecture is accessible, relevant and contextual, accessible to whom? Only the architectural camaraderie or beyond, relevant to whom? To the context in which we live, and contextual in the total socioeconomic, cultural, and environmental sustainability of what we want to see the future to be. What is the state of the art with writing architecture? Has it been limited to the specialists? Can it become more interdisciplinary, accessible across specialisms, including tourism and journalism? In fact, 2 months ago, the Indian government launched the new national education policy after 36 years. It calls explicitly for interdisciplinarity. And where I am at Ananta National University, our board of management has endorsed an interdisciplinary framework, the way we teach, research, and engage in architecture and design and creative practice. So what are the potentials and possibilities? Let's not define them, let's discuss and debate them. their range of opportunities as we forge forward with new discourses, new practices, what kinds of capabilities and capacities to use Professor Amartya Sen's theoretical framework do we need to embed in the professional and educational agencies? How do we assess the layers of significance in architecture to communicate placemaking and contextual places? And I say this diachronically, that is with historical depth in time and synchronically in contemporary present, because there are many layers that we need to unravel, not just look at a romanticized historical past, but all of this informs, as Professor Romila Thapa, well-known Indian historian, says, contemporary past through which we appreciate and understand, continually interpret, reinterpret the past. Could we promote a genre of writing architecture that is decolonized? In a lot of countries, you know, literature is still from Global North is the one that's used for students, for reference, and yet we have such rich literature in languages of the South, which is relevant, we're very engaging, and that we need to access, both for our students and also for our practice. And so the practice of writing architecture in local languages in a post-colonial context, it's much wanted, and I think that that's something that we need to promote. These are some of the contestations, because in each webinar, we challenge so that we can stimulate thinking among our participants, among ourselves that are participating here. In order to, you know, provide the critical engagement in this webinar, we are honored and privileged to have Dr. Vendu Nurianti, who is Professor of Architecture and Planning at Gajimada University, which is the number one university in Indonesia. In fact, when I was at the Australian National University, we had cross credits with University of Gajimada. But what is also important is that she played such an important role in the conservation of Borobudur post the earthquake that she became world famous for the kind of professionalism and integrity through scholarship that she demonstrated. And she became the Vice Minister of Education and Culture for Indonesia. How I wish we all have architects and planners and designers as ministers of education and culture. Wouldn't that be wonderful for our professions and our universities? And then we have Nandini Somaya Sampath, an architect and solicitor and director of SNK Somaya and Kalapa Consultants. And I'm actually holding for you to look at one of the amazing, amazing monographs she produced last year. And what I love about it is it says an architectural monograph at the bottom. And it is a documentation and critical reflection on post-independent, the whole evolution of the architectural discourse in India, but within a global context. And this is the kind of writing that we need in Global South that is grounded in our own post-colonial realities. And then finally, we have architect Neha Nair, who is an assistant professor, one of my very young, brilliant colleagues in the Faculty of Architecture at Ananta National University. And this is the next generation. You know, we look up to, we look forward to, in the way architectural discourse will evolve. And as is our usual practice in Heritage Matters webinars, each one of our panelists will speak for about 8 minutes, and then we will open up for questions and discussions. So please use the Q&A box at the bottom of your screen and send your questions very focused and relevant, right, to this webinar. I will moderate them. All right, thank you very much. Now I think I'm going to hand over to Professor Vendu Nurianti. Professor Nurianti.
Thank you so much, Professor Gala, for having me here. And I also must congratulate Anand University for having this event. I think this is a wonderful event that talking about very important and very unique topic. In fact, writing architecture because there's so little attention is being paid on this particular problem areas. So I'm glad that this evening, I can join to meet all the important speakers tonight and meeting and break it, you friends, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, when I got this title, Writing Architecture, I remember about a book on writing architecture by Carter Wiseman, who said that for ages, architects have been criticized for speaking on insular language, known to some as archi-speak. So, speaking among themselves, understood by themselves. So, but anyone who produces, promotes, and teaches architecture must depend on the accurate analysis in order to produce the restful work of architecture. I think it's centered on a core idea. Therefore, writing on architecture should be inseparable from the design process itself. So, writing and designing is inseparable. So, this is the one that more even complicated area because of those intertwined issues. I'm going to talk briefly about three things here. First of all, it's about writing and the creative process. And second is about the Indonesian experience that I wish to share here with the audience. And the last one is what is the lesson learned about this writing architecture and how we move ahead? First of all, writing is a creative process here that the nature of architecture itself with the creative element is a form of a black box. So it is like the capturing lightning in the bottle because the creativity is a world of imagination, creativity, imagination, and interpretation. So sometimes the leaps of creativity is so fast that it cannot be structured into writing or language. So the architect leaps from imagination to ideas endlessly. This is, I think, the process which is highly the opposite of the structure process like writing. So in my opinion, this is why architects don't believe in method, but believe in values. So it is not just about describing a space, but creating the feeling, creating the atmosphere of the space. So, okay, for the Indonesian experience, as you may aware that Indonesia, we have the three more than 350 years of colonization by the Dutch, contrasted with 200 years probably of British rule for India. So in Indonesia, there is a more oral tradition than writing tradition. This is even making more writing architecture complicated because there are many layer of architecture influences and expression over millennia, including the indigenous architecture, vernaculars, Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim, also in recent centuries, Dutch influences. So there is a great deal of cross-cutting sensitivity among all these layers. You cannot just write from a narrow architectural technical point of view, but you have to express the multidimensional space involving all the contextual, social, political, cultural, religious, and other elements of the architecture in your writing and interpretation. So, struggling with this layer of heritage here. So, when we have to express the past heritage, always bring up to the present and the future. What to preserve, and how to justify the integration between the past, the present, and the future. So a last thing that how what is the lesson to be learned about this writing architecture here? That architecture to me is not just about buildings, but as a total cultural expression of contextual values, ethics, politically correctness, socially acceptability, environmental awareness, etc. So then writing no longer means just writing, but with the role of technologies now, I think, we have entered the new reality, the virtual reality, even the hyper realities. Those are that you can show so much of the visual aspect and the context that are very dominant. So the last point I like to make here is that with this new landscape we facing of this game changer, people no longer treat written text in the same way or read the text as the same way as we used to do. So we are so much more visually oriented in this era, the image oriented. The role of new technologies has become the new game changers that dominated by the image and visuality. So this is all the issues that we have to face now. And how do we do about this? And how do we transform the tradition of writing has to be deal with. So all the questions that Professor Gala was asking before we start this webinar, I think are very much relevant that make us think, how do we go about this? And how do we, and what is the implementation, the implication on our daily architectural designing, writing, and those intertwined between the two. Well, thank you very much. I'd like to have, after this discussion with all you, and I return the time to you, Professor Gala. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Professor Noriandi. Really appreciate it. You brought in such richness conceptually. You talked about atmosphere of the place. You talked about, you referred to it, and you're a global expert on safeguarding intangible heritage, how intangible elements are also important, you know, as we deal with writing architecture. You mentioned ethics. You mentioned, you know, blended, you know, the kind of blended situations we have right now. How do we rethink, you know, what is the role of image and what is the role of the discourse itself? Really appreciate that thought-provoking presentation. Thank you very much. Now, you referred to ethics, and one of the people that I admire enormously in India about ethical approaches and their firm SNK Associates is Nandini Sampat. Nandini, over to you now. By the way, I'm not doing detailed introductions because what we found with Heritage Matters webinars is people Google all the names before they decide to register for the webinar. So they know more about you than I can introduce in a short period of time. So Nandini, over to you.
Thank you. It is wonderful to be a part of Heritage Matters series focusing on writing architecture today. I would like to thank Professor Amareswar Gala and Anant University for inviting me to be part of this webinar. We write to taste life twice, in the moment and in the retrospect. This is the words of a French-Cuban-American novelist, Anaïs Nin. After 4 decades of working in India and over 200 designed and built works, the time had come to document the incredible journey of the Indian architect Binda Somaya. It had to be her voice, the story of each project she had lived it, the simplicity in language, reflection of the architectural process and methodology, and bringing in people and subjects that have been integral part of her journey. It had to be a reflection of her belief that, in her words, architecture through its design has to raise the human spirit of all those who pass through its doors. This led to the creation of the book, Brinda Somaya, Works and Continuities. To briefly talk about the process of making this book, I thought I would cover it briefly. Amar's holding it up. Thank you, Amar. In three parts, the team, the structure and the stories, and finally the writing. So when we first talk about the team, Brinda Somaya has a gift of working with people with great ease and humility. She believes that her work is a lifetime of collaborations with the people of her studio, with her clients, and with her city and country. For the making of this book, her voice is loud and clear, but is constantly interwoven with the many individuals she has worked with, interacted with, and those that have been her companions and friends through the years. It took a dedicated team and the support of our foundation, Hekar, and our design studio, SNK, Tina Nusirabad, our book designer, and Mappin Publishing to bring out the book. We collaborated very closely with architect Rituraj Parikh to structure the book, Professor Mary Woods of Cornell University as our guide and consultant, and me as the editor of the book. My role was to ensure that the stories were told in the spirit and intention that Mrs. Somaya had intended, with great honesty, integrity, and a book that could be read by anyone who was interested in reading about her story. The second part I want to talk about is about structure and the stories. The book opens with a foreword by James Polchek, the renowned American architect, collaborator, and friend of Mrs. Somaya. And it covers 13 projects or typologies of works of significance across the decades and is interspersed with conversations on India, on the city of Mumbai, and architecture and culture with Minister Arun Shori, the late Professor Kamu Iyer, Professor Mary Woods, and art historian Saryu Doshi. The book also contains a critical analysis of Brinda Somaya's work and collaborations in a series of essays authored by Australian author Professor John Lang, Professor Porus Olwala of Cornell University, American architects Todd Williams and Billy Sien, and many others. In conclusion of the book, it was essential to chronologically archive the over 200 design and build projects, which has been done in a thumbnail format with relevant details. Now to just the last portion, which is what we're speaking today, the writing. One day I will find the right words and they will be simple. The words of American novelist Jack Kerouac. The process of writing is very subjective. Each author must find their own methodology. The process for this book began with Mrs. Somaya recording her stories on each project individually and in great detail. These were then transcribed and then developed upon greater detail while being supported with photographs, drawings, and other ancillary materials to continue to visually balance the narrative. Architecture is not an easy profession. It is filled with challenges that must be met in order to deliver a built form of quality and as envisioned. It was important to address issues like women in construction, local arts and crafts, structural challenges, geographical and cultural issues, material and sustainable practice, and much more. While engaging with all of the above, we also had to maintain a strong sense of integrity and ethical standards. The story had to cover these across different dimensions, a narrative of the truth, of the ground realities, and of the achievements as well. Having worked with her for over a decade at the time when I was editing this book, I had the distinct advantage of understanding the projects, the architect, and the journey in a very unique perspective. But with that came a great responsibility to ensure that the final product that emerged was one that encompassed all of the above that I've spoken of with a sense of honesty and beauty, all of which we find in Brinda Somaya's work. I would like to just end with a reading from the introduction of the book, which was written by me. To have a chance to observe a successful woman at her profession is an experience that any individual is fortunate to witness. But I have seen a successful woman work, love, and live. This is my fortune. Greater still, that she is my mother. The lesson that she continues to impart each day is to work with great humility, and that comes with ease when one is fiercely passionate about what they do. In her words, as an architect, I believe that all architectural practices that are inclusive and span our diverse population, be it economic or cultural, provide us with great satisfaction. Therefore, the motivation for inclusion and diversity should not come only from the desire to create a just society, but also because it leads to a better and more powerful creative processes and solutions. So thank you, everyone. I very much look forward to this panel and discussing the many points brought in by Dr. Gala and, of course, the other panelists.
Thank you, Nandini. Really appreciated it. I think you finished off by saying certain key things, understanding how, you know, that understanding that's there as we create is something that needs to be shared, and it needs to be shared you know, with humility, you know, but also in very simple language. And I mean simple, not diminishing language itself, but remembering Ernest Hemingway, when he wrote Old Man and the Sea and won the Nobel Prize for it, it was his 56th in a version revision, 56. It is one of the most amazing books written. And I think if we can write with that kind of diction and clarity and understanding, I think that everybody should become aware of, you know, how architecture contributes to our sense of place and identity. And I think that you've raised a number of things. And what I love is, you know, that long journey, you know, of Brinda Somaya that you so well, you and your colleagues documented as an amazing collaboration, is consistently ethical and has got integrity. I think that's really critical in our doggy dog world, where there's so much competition for, you know, tenders and consultancies and so on. So it's you know, these are the kind of role models we need, but they have to be communicated. The values have to be communicated. And I think that's what you and your team have done a brilliant job. Thank you so much. Now I'm going to move on to young Neha Nair. I keep saying young because at Anant National University, we have a practice of engaging, you know, in each webinar with our young people. In fact, among the participants, there are a lot of young people. I think across the world, among our registered participants, not all the ones are online right now. A lot of them will be listening when they wake up or whatever, or when they finish their dinner. Our young people, you know, and Neha is part of that generation. So Neha is going to tell us what it all means, because this webinar is inspired by her, you know, as a young person wanting to start architectural journalism at my university. Neha, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. And I'm very humbled and honored to be a part of this panel. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to be among such, you know, esteemed speakers. To start with, so I'm going to talk about what writing and how writing can play a role in architecture. So architecture is usually understood and accepted as a profession with visuals as its means of communication. Ranging from diagrams, drawings, models, sketches, architecture is predominantly perceived and explained in a visual format. So it cannot be denied that drawings are crucial and help shape the idea and result in the execution of the design. But a good drawing should also and can explain every detail that is a part of the building. And as a result, quite often the importance of writing in architecture is debated, stating the drawings do all the work and hence words are probably not required. But it is important to realize that any architectural intervention in the environment does not stop at its construction, and it goes much beyond. It is important that these implications are recorded and documented for today and for the future to look back, because it has societal, cultural, economical, political associations which need to be interpreted and evaluated and analyzed. So when we look back at history, a lot of information is derived from written materials and architecture by means of treatises and travelogues. They help us establish a connection with our heritage, of which no real architectural drawings are available. And these documents broaden our understanding as they include not just the built environment, but also the people and the culture. They are reminders to all of us of the importance that words can play. And also, as architecture students and as faculties now, we have been taught and we teach how architecture is for the people of the society. And we often discuss how architecture shapes the society. And like how IMP had said, architecture is a very mirror of your life. But this understanding, in my opinion, is limited to the architectural fraternity and fails to go beyond the close-knit community and to the entire society in general. In the current times, when the society is much well-informed, voices their opinions and participates actively in the society, it is crucial that the built environment is written about and the importance of architecture in shaping its life is discussed with them directly. And to clarify my stand, I am not trying to say that writing is not already a part of the field of architecture, but rather I'm trying to say that the importance it holds and I'm trying to emphasize the importance it holds and trying to discuss the limited practice of writing in this field. The society, in my understanding, the Indian cultural situation, we still look, when it comes to history, we still look at the Indo-Islamic and the Indo-Saracenic as our historic built environment or as historic architecture. And it is because from school books to Twitter, when it comes to history, this is what is portrayed as historic or historic architecture or built environment. But the modern Indian architecture, the post-independent Indian built environment, the changes that were led and what created the entire post-Indian architecture, which and the start to which is what we see in the contemporary times, that is kind of faded away. And with writing as a means, we can help realize the importance of this also as being as important and crucial as a part of our country and the history that it has created. And this probably, like I said, gets neglected, or the post-independent gets neglected, because of the lack of written material on it, and especially by the people who've lived it, or for that matter, Indian citizens, because we often have to go back or refer to foreign citizens coming to our country, understanding the situation, and then writing and talking about it. Another important observation that I would like to make is that most architectural writing is often limited to the design of the building rather than its impacts and implications. I also believe that writing about architecture shall help explore the complexities and mysteries that comprise not only the built, but also the unbuilt. The interwoven realities of mankind can surface only if they are written and discussed, not just within the fraternity, of course, but with the society as well. The intangible realities of beliefs, values, aspirations, technology, material, which behind the camera, they are the ones which actually mold and help manifest the built design. But they kind of get hidden away, and they need to be brought back into communication and discussions through writings. And India has had a very long legacy of built environment, and writing will help establish discussions and dialogues from diverse standpoints of study. So writing in any form, blogs to books, newspaper, magazine articles, research papers, should all help create this dialogue and make built environment and architecture an inclusive and approachable field, which often is considered to be a niche apart. And making it interdisciplinary, because within the architects and the designers, but foraying into the many different fields, would also help improve and bridge the gap that architecture and society usually witnesses. One way of ensuring this, since I am in academia, I will obviously kind of lean towards it, is definitely including writing in architecture in the educational system, right from the undergraduate programs by starting off little pieces of writing to offering detailed specialized courses in the postgraduate, which shall help make writing a regular and an inclusive, integral practice. And another aspect of viewing, like I said, interdisciplinary. Now, architecture, like we all know, it is not just about the design, but it has engineering. It has laws that need to be taken care of. It has economics to be understood. It has cultural implications. And this is the multidiscipline inclusion that I would like to insist and talk about. When all these perspectives start building up and are discussed, then there is a more approachability to architecture among the society and within the people, and the connection is much better established. The social media that we are all connected and bound by is already acting as a catalyst to play a huge role in diminishing the differences between the various fields that are there. And architecture just needs to adapt and embrace this change and move forward with it. And another important aspect when writing an architecture in our country especially is to be discussed. I would like to add that writing in local languages should be encouraged, again, to increase and improve the reach of the built environment among the different people, including multiple perspectives of looking at the built environment, initiating discussions of how the independent India was shaped and formed, and how it continues to make the society that we currently lived in, are all these things that writing can do for the field of architecture. And this will not only help make everyone aware and informed, but this awareness and information will probably imbibe a sense of responsibility and ownership to the built environment among the non-architects or among society in general. And hence, we will be able to take better care of the built environment and also maybe build better. So either ways, we will be able to, writing will be able to help is what my opinion is. And to end it all, in Hindi, we often use this phrase, which is kaha likha hai, you know, which means where is it written? So whenever we need any affirmation or a proof, we often go and we often use this phrase in our conversation. So I guess we should be ready and prepared to have an answer if somebody comes up and asks us kaha likha hai. That's all that I would like to say. Thank you,
Neha. That was wonderful. So we look forward to a future of amazing writings, you know, from, you know, your generation and the next generation that you are teaching, that you'll be teaching. And I think that very well said, you know, from we need youth voices, youth perspectives, but also I just want to mention to the participants that women in architectural writing, women in architecture is still undervalued, and this is where the Brinda Somaya book that Nandini, you know, has produced actually foregrounds in many ways, you know, sort of the role of women in this. But historically, we still need to do research to understand because not much has been written. But also you mentioned about, you know, what we often refer to as the J.S. Mill British colonial legacy is, you know, the kind of Hindu architecture, Islamic architecture. We need to decolonize our discourse. As we decolonize our discourse, as you said, we also need to start thinking of some of the jargon that we use, like vernacular, you know, which is a legacy of modernity, you know, which is very colonial legacy, if you will. And also we need to think of a whole range of other new nuances that we address. And I think that, you know, you and Professor Windu, both of you referred to intangible heritage. In fact, all the three of you did. And so I'd like to get back to Professor Nurianti. Are you there, Professor Nurianti? We can't see you.
Yes, yeah, I'm here.
Yes. Professor Nurianti, tell me, you played such a significant role, especially in the Asia Pacific, with the UNESCO Category Center, two center, And with Indonesia, you know, which is one of the leading countries in the way it safeguards intangible heritage, to what extent has your, you know, particular expertise and knowledge and commitment to safeguarding living heritage contributed to the, you know, to the architectural discourse in Indonesia?
Yeah, it is very challenging, you know, working in this area. While what I said before, you have so many layers of the architectural heritage. And as you know very well, we have 17,000 islands, more than 700 ethnic groups, plus 400 languages. And then within that, could you imagine the traditional villages that spread out all over Indonesia? So this is both tangible and intangible. Then it's not just about the architecture as a living space, but also architecture as a total expression of culture, of tradition. You know, so the whole thing become very complicated when you actually deal with some of the islands are so developed, like Java, for example, which has more than 70 or maybe 80 population of all of Indonesia. And the rest, on the 16,999 islands with just a very little population. So as you well know that all the gap, this gap, you know, it's not just about number, population, but also it's about the lack of the development. You deal with the most remote island that probably they live like in the primitive ways, but also you have so modern cities like Jakarta, very much like Bombay, I think, you know, big city, more than maybe 15 million population in one city, and traffic jams everywhere, but less than 3 hours, you suddenly in the middle of the remote island. So all the gap here, it becomes the, what you call it, that when you deal with safeguarding, both tangible and intangible, then the role of the community, which is the other one, is so advanced, so established with all kind of structure and civilization, but the rest are the community that living in a very subsistence level. So of course then you will have the complexities in terms of safeguarding heritage in both ways. So therefore I think, you know, like when we trying to establish all the category 2 centers, for we have to identify most relevant issues that we have to face. Like for example, Java Man, you know, which is one of the most important link in the civilization, basically the cradle of civilization. So the category 2 center of the Java Man here, which have links to all of Asia and Asia Pacific, become the center that we depends on how this civilization become the role model of all of islands. And the second one is still trying this one, is the category 2 center for the readiness human resource, especially for the heritage that you deal with disaster, like where I live now, you know, is 20 minutes from Borobudur Temple, the biggest Buddhist temple in the world, 20 minutes away from Prambanan, one of the biggest temples, Hindu temple in the world. So within 1 hour, this is the influence of the tangible heritage, world level tangible heritage, but also only 15 minutes, less than 15 minutes away, you have one of the most active volcano in the world, like Merapi. So all the potential disaster here, at the same time, I don't think that we would have all the temples like Borobudur, like Prambanan, unless we have this the source of it is the volcano itself. So we see the volcano is like part of our intangible heritage, cultural heritage, actually. We don't see as a, yes, it is a geological phenomenon, but also it is a culture, intangible source of intangible cultural heritage and our place. So it's just said the complexities.
Thank you, Professor Nuryanti. Yes, complexity indeed. And your emphasis on the way we seamlessly deal with that which is tangible and intangible as we create, because architecture is about creativity. And but we don't create in thin air, but we create in a context. And I think that both in your publications, but also your public speeches, lectures, you've demonstrated this, and also in practice, how you've implemented policies in this area. So really appreciate it. Now, one of the questions is coming, and I think it's Nandini who is going to address this. It's coming all the way from near Jodhpur in the desert of Rajasthan, from an amazing, you know, family and community project dealing with intangible heritage of indigenous architecture, indigenous culture. So the director from there is asking the question that when we write this, what you call complexity, both of you did, where do the communities, you know, where do the community groups from those places, where do they stand in the writing architecture, both in the urban and rural areas? And I'm asking you this question, Nandini, because the volume you produced is a phenomenal collaboration that brought so many people together, so many voices together, and you made sure the first voice of the people who, for lack of a better word I'm using in architectural jargon, the clients, you know, you brought in their voices as well, the community groups. How do you do this? I mean, it's so complicated. How did you come up with the methodology for this?
I think it's a very interesting question. I think it all comes down to inclusivity. We always talk about this as we work. As architects, we have such a important responsibility towards the built and the unbuilt. All these aspects that were just talked about by Dr. Nuryanti just now and yourself, Amar. And when we have the opportunity to look at any single project, you have to look at where you are, contextually where you are, what's the community you're looking at, what are the lives you're affecting. Of course, there's that direct responsibility to the client to make sure their vision and their requirements are adhered to. But especially in a country like India, where Dr. Nuryanti also talked about this wonderful idea of layers of heritage, where we're blessed to have layers of heritage wherever we go. And, you know, it's one of the gifts of working in India as an architect, I believe. And so when we have the opportunity to work, I think the first thing we do is understand the place, understand the context of where you are, and really do research so you can respect that sense of space and identity and understanding. Where is it all coming from? And then, of course, we bring that idea of context and history of the tangible and intangible into our design in many different ways. I think for the last 40 years, I remember Ms. Sumaya first convincing a client to please keep 5% of the project cost towards arts and crafts, local arts and crafts of where the project is we're doing. And we still do that today. We've managed to increase the budget over time as well. And it's been absolutely such an integral part of the design process to include the community in these different ways, whether it's through arts and crafts, whether it's through building itself, whether it's through the research process. And this is what I think has made our projects live on. Many of the projects that we covered out of, you know, almost all the projects we photographed, none had been destroyed or removed after many, many years. They had become a part of the community. We photographed projects after 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and they were still standing there. And that in itself, I think, is reassurance to us that what we have built, we have done with respect to what has been around, so it didn't have to go away. Even when we did the rehabilitation of the village in Kutch after the the earthquake, which is one of the projects we've covered here, that was in 2000. And we went back every 5 to 8 years to see what was happening in the village. And we had a little girl there called Mezabin, and she must have been 5 or 6 years old when the village was devastated. And after the restoration of their homes in the village, we recorded her life till date. And now she's a working girl, finished college. And we've seen Mezabin grow in that village that we managed to rehabilitate. So what has it meant for that person, for that community, and beyond? And of course, this extends right from the rural areas that we build in, right to the commercial big corporate projects where there is now, a CSR, a need for responsibility towards the community. So we can really cover the breadth. You know, there is that ability as architects to cover that breadth. So I think that's some of the ways we are able to do it.
Nandini, that's wonderful the way you responded. There are many possibilities. It's not because of limitations. There are possibilities, but it needs us to rethink the way we move forward. So that's what you're saying. But I have, before I move on to the next comment or question, I just want to say one thing, Nandini. It'll be wonderful if you can actually write an article on the methodology of producing that volume. We would love to publish it internationally in one of the journals that I edit from Champaign-Urbana. We'd love to publish it. So please think about it. Now, next one is, I want to read out a comment. This is, I think, more to Neha. Neha, this is a compliment. Bravo, you're getting a compliment. Architects have been self-indulged in research and theoretical or philosophical beliefs in writing. I agree with Nihanar viewpoint to diversify. Right, architectural writing must reach out for the inclusivity and create awareness about the profession's goals to the broader audience. So there you are, Neha, you're getting a big support there. And then, like our participants come from many parts of the world, like I said. So including small island development states. I mean, in fact, we had Alessandra Cummins as one of our panelists not all that long ago. So this is coming from the Caribbean, St. Lucia. Our architecture is labeled French colonial or British colonial as a result of our traditional and pre-colonial building techniques and materials are ignored. Do the panelists have any advice on reclaiming the narrative of a built heritage? Would renaming it be too ambitious? So I think we know about this in India, and Afros Nuryanti will say yes, also Indonesia, where we had to reclaim our indigenous knowledge systems. Anybody on the panel, Neha, do you want to have a go? How are you going to translate this into your future curricula and teaching?
So we also in our, like I said, when it comes to history, we only refer to the Indo-Islamic and the Indo-Saracenic. But interestingly, the word Indo, I think it is important to realize that when the Islamic architecture entered our country, or when the colonial or the British architecture entered our country, because of the local artisans who were actually building, the Indo automatically got attached to these foreign styles and foreign styles of building and architecture. And it created a new style or a new type in totality. So I think even when in all the colonized places, when architecture is referred to as British or French, it is important to realize that there is always a part of the indigenous and the traditional building styles and materials and techniques that are used, and writing in addressing the society in general, and writing with not the style of architecture as its core, but the entire past or the history that led to this particular style, if that is discussed, people realize the amalgamation of these two different styles. And in terms of renaming, personally, I think that renaming usually, and since we have a lot of renaming states and a history of renaming places in our country prevalent, I think renaming usually creates an agitation of being familiar with something and trying to turn it around. But the realization of this amalgamation is probably what will help more than the entire renaming and creating it like a rebellious activity. So.
Thank you, Neha. Would anyone else like to add first, Nuriyanti or Nandini? Would you like to add to that? Nandini, go ahead.
Well, I think most of our countries, as Amar, you said, have gone through this many influences, especially with architecture. It's interesting the way Neha talked about it is we've got to talk about the different voices that are available in our country when it comes to architecture. And, there's such variety and diversity that's available, and there are always labels put to it, and there's so many technical aspects and so much historical references that we can go into. What we must do is look at it as our legacies and our treasures, and not build what barriers or boundaries around them, but actually embrace them as part of a rich history that we have. And, when I recall when we were restoring the Rajabhai Tower, and you see the detailings, exactly what Neha was talking about, there's an amalgamation. Of course, there's such British colonial influence, but then you'll see, men with turbans and animals from the jungles of the Maharashtra coastline. And, there's such great beauty in architecture to see the amalgamation of details come together and to understand where that history came from and to understand the workmen who actually, carved it out and the design that went into it. There were students from JJ College who had designed all these little details. And so, just to think about one small carved piece like that and what is its history, how was it formed, and that it was a fusion of ideas and cultures and heritage that came together. And that should be the celebration and the discussion. So, of course, I think, there are many ways to look at it, but I would always think of it as a celebration.
Thank you, Nandini. That's why in our question, we had layers of significance. And, it's really critical. Thank you very much. Professor Nuriyanti, would you like to add to that?
Yeah. The colonial architecture is one of the richness of Indonesian architecture. But again, as we all understood, sometimes we have to face the problem of what to preserve, to what extent that the colonial era still have the space in the complexities of all the architecture's influence, especially when you have this ethnic group. They have all the traditional architecture all over Indonesia, and the condition of it, as you well know, the gap between the two are so wide. So again, sometimes this kind of tensions that need to be overcome, especially again to the involvement of the craftsmanship that is so different, between the two era. And you can see actually it's not just from the architecture style, architecture expression, but also how they shape the community and the community behavior. So again, the concept of space then become or need to be redefined, because sometimes the local they tend not to have the privilege to enjoy the space and the architecture within the colonial era. So all these things in some certain areas still exist, even though we understand that we should be so grateful with the variety of the architectural history and diversification in Indonesia. But as we all well understand that the limitation of the knowledge, the level of education, and the how we actually make use of the resources, the resource allocation within the space is just so much different. So again, now when you compare between all those layers of architectural heritage within those different era, we can see that all the buildings, the quality of the building, the way they interpret the space, is not just in terms of physical, but also non-physical, it's just different. So this become sometimes what you call it like a problematic when architect has to decide how this one will have to be living together in, you know, harmoniously. So I think that's what I need to add.
Thank you so much, Professor Nuryanti. I mean, all the three of you are getting compliments from Brazil to Rajasthan for your answers, you know, sort of, which is just amazing. And in fact, from Brazil, you know, where they're dealing with a lot of these issues of architecture, decolonization, layers of significance, is a very big thank you from an architect from Rio de Janeiro. And but what I want to do is take you to the next question to all of you, I think, from Spain. Architectural journalism is yet to be explored for sure. With the current generation and budding students, it is observed that mostly they're concerned on financial support of the profession, except for those who are passionate. In the recent past, there are many situations where people switching careers would like to hear the opinions of the panelists on this. So anyone, I mean, I'm quite outrageous in India, known for saying that the majority of architecture graduates don't get jobs in their disciplines. So I think switching careers, you know. So who wants to go? Neha, it's your generation person from Spain who asks these questions. Go for it first.
Yes, I think there is, you can't really deny on the entire financial, you know, the finances being the primary importance, and due to which and other reasons, people tend to switch careers. But like I said, if we start foraying into these parallel, so architecture is not just design, it has so many layers to it. And if we start in, you know, kind of accepting this fact, and not really stick to this closed bubble that usually, I know I probably shouldn't be saying this, but then architects tend to stick to their own bubble. So maybe if in education we can break that bubble, go beyond, have interdisciplinary, the character of interdisciplinary imparted and imbibed in our education system itself, people will probably realize that studying architecture, and then probably when they are at their careers, they don't really have to switch, but they can walk into these many different threads that lead from architecture into other, if at all that is their interest, not necessarily leave it all behind, because there are there is an urban scale, there are laws that need to be taken care of when it comes to the built environment. There is economics, politics, culture, writing, like we're discussing right now. So with architecture as their background, there are many more options that are possible, and hence not necessarily switching. Once we have that as our as what we teach at universities and different colleges, maybe this act of switching will reduce, and having architecture as the base will spread out into these multiple different fields that we are actually related to.
Thank you, Neha. Anyone wants to add to that in the panel?
Yeah, I'll say real quick, Amar. I think it's a very difficult profession. We're churning out a lot of architecture students. It needs to be a profession where there's much more respect in India given to it. You know, I switched the other way. I went from law to architecture. So being a lawyer, where I see a completely different, when a client comes to me, the way or goes to a doctor or goes to a chartered accountant, the same respect should be given to architects, which I think has to evolve and happen in India. And I think it's very tough for young students coming out. It's a very competitive area. But like I said, we all need to raise the bar of the architecture industry together, whether it's ethics, practice, education, all of it as one, and really, you know, bring up that standard. And at the same time, talking about what Neha said is we had the Women in Design conference earlier this year where we talked about architecture being the master of the arts and how the beauty of it is it touches all other professions. So today with an education in architecture, absolutely, as she's saying, you know, you can go into photography, you can go into graphic design, archaeology. I mean, the world is your oyster, really. So today's generation does have that ability to really flow beyond into film, into conservation. So there's a lot to go beyond architecture. That's the beauty of it as a subject. But I think we really have to look seriously at the profession within India and how can we raise it together as a community and elevate it so that, you know, people can be proud to be architects. And as tough as the profession is, you want to remain in it.
Thanks, Nandini. Professor Nuryanti, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, I think in Indonesia, being an architect, sometimes be seen as a risky profession. You know, it could be risky. Either you're very successful or you can fail. So this division, the gap between the two are so big. So I think the still the dialogue between whether architect is a professionals or architect as a scientist, or the difference between architect as more as an artist or architect more as a technocrat, you know. So these two probably something to do with the curriculum in the architectural teaching, but I guess is people still see sometimes that architecture is not really science, you know. It's more like a artist. It's more like a art a world. So sometimes when you see, one day I saw a treasure study in Indonesia that most of the architect graduate actually more than 78% they work in the non-architectural field. So, but they are very successful either as a banker or as a business in the property side, in the, you know, non-architectural field, but they're very successful. So I guess there's something to do with the one I just said before at the beginning of my speech, which is creativity is the core of this world. So it's actually you creating something that doesn't exist before, something that from none to existence. That's where the creativity become the central of the profession. So I think this is powerful for the any profession, you know, whatever you involve, since you already trained in this world and it's becoming creating something, you know, I think this probably is, it's the privilege of the architects. And they no matter, you know, what feel, I think once you have this as a pillar of your journey, then I think this guarantee for success.
Thank you, Professor Nuryanti. That's very eloquent the way you explained it. Before I move on, there's a wonderful suggestion. Perhaps this is for Neha. This is a one of the global experts on intangible heritage and who specializes in folk life, one of the domains of intangible heritage safeguarding, and suggesting that if you actually encourage students of architecture to discover their local architecture of their own areas, then they enjoy it, they understand, they appreciate it with full senses. As we say in India, hisas, you know, with all the senses, and experience them in the built form, then you'll begin a tradition of intangible heritage of architecture. So let us, as she says, right the rooms of all spaces, right the rooms of all, that's a brilliant expression. I'll pass this on to you. This should start at the beginning of learning and finish with the story of their professional practical projects. I mean, I'm sure you all agree, because the question is whether you agree with that. What do you think? I think we all agree that, in fact, if we can get them to feel with their senses. I mean, in fact, I taught a course on postgraduate course on intangible heritage 2 months ago. And because of the lockdown, I got all the Anand fellows who were my students to work within their own homes, the intangible heritage of, you know, the stories that their grandma told them, the lullabies that their mother sang, the kind of on festive occasions, what does the family cook? What is the architecture of their place? What is their streetscape? What do they grow in their garden? I mean, these are the kinds of things, you know, sort of it not only enriched their own appreciation, as in their feedback, they've said this emphatically, but it also built a sense of belonging, you know, that learning is not about something out there, but also here, it's both. And so I think that's wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Sky Morrison from Toronto, for your input. And then I have another comment, I guess, also a question from one of the most well-known anthropologists of India from the Northeast, who was the director of Indira Gandhi Rashtriya Manav Sangrahalaya, Professor Nuriyanti. That's like our National Museum of Anthropology, if you will. And that the appreciation, what role museums, especially community-grounded museums, where the architecture design is locally grounded in the intangible heritage of the place, and the issues and concern about promoting indigenous architecture, whether it's Indonesia, whether it's India, you know, the panel would like to briefly address it. The role of community-based museums that deal with living heritage in promoting architectural discourse, indigenous architectural discourse. Anyone wants to answer? Come on, Professor Nuriyanti, you're an expert in this area.
I think it's definitely that's the key, that community is definitely the key of this creating this architectural, indigenous architecture. And this is, I mean, we deal with this like forever, basically. And as we can see, all the traditional architecture in 17,000 island, and they all, you know, the different, the gap and everything. So the indigenous, we can still see the indigenous architecture is still around us, even within the, all the high rise buildings, you know, they survive somehow. And so, what is the actually the key success for this, or the resilience, if I would say, the power for them to become the very resilient in this case? I think is one is the Indonesian terminology, we call it like gotong royong. It means like we work together. This is from the lowest level in the village until the highest level in the society. The gotong royong concept is either you build a house, you build a village, it's based on the community-based architecture. So I think probably this is the most powerful that architecture still survive, no matter, you know, what influence from all this globalization and stuff. So this gotong royong concept until now, even adapted by the Ministry of Public Works and Housing to be the one of the policy that the government, and we also now are implementing this to build homestays, you know, around 600 homestays around Borobudur. Using this gotong royong concept, which is they build on themselves, which by done by community and designed by community and what's based on what community needs. So we adapted this into the modern system, especially for the building materials, the building management, but still based on this gotong royong concepts. And this is just so wonderful, so beautiful to see how the diversity in terms of transforming the indigenous architecture into the modern era.
Thanks, Rosa Nuryanti. Thanks for that very illustrative response. There are a lot of questions coming. We're running out of time, I hope. Some of them are comments asking whether you agree with it. So I'm going to read it out. Architectural vocabulary needs to be inclusive of local terminologies, and there's a need to rewrite local histories in the local context. Do panelists agree on the use of state language articles in architecture journals as a responsibility? I mean, this is a big issue that's coming up in many countries, that all the articles are written in English or French or whatever, but we need to write more articles in local journals and in the local languages. And I think it's really important. Otherwise, so much of our living heritage and our knowledge systems are eroding very gradually. So if you don't do it, then we're going into neo-colonial discourse. And I can see all the three of you nodding, so I'm going to leave it there. And boy, they're coming very fast, these questions. And Nandini, this is the one for you and everybody, given I'm the only male here on this panel. What is the role of gender in writing architecture? Anyone can answer, all the three of you can answer, but Nandini has been,
short,
you know.
Short question and powerful question. It is a very interesting question. Actually, it's a double-edged sword when I think of it in many ways. There shouldn't be any difference when writing the architecture, but if I was to read the monograph we've brought out and maybe some male monographs that have come out, and there's so many, this is one of the few monographs on a woman architect that we've managed to bring out. And I think one of the most interesting differences is addressing other issues beyond yourself, beyond the architecture. And Ms. Sumaya says this a lot, what is beyond the buildings? And, you know, we've talked about so much of that today. We've talked about the tangible and the intangible. We've talked about communities. We worry and we talk very much about construction labor and women in construction and how that works. So all these aspects that are beyond the building, but such an integral part of discussing it when we are talking about the built form. And sometimes that gets lost in translation in certain, and I feel perhaps there's a more empathetic view coming from women architects and even maybe writers. And I'm sure, you know, even Neha will have comments on this as well. And, you know, whether we look at it with that motherly empathy in a different way, that it is this sense of responsibility for the larger good than just as a singular building. So that would be one aspect, and I'm sure there are plenty more, but one perspective.
Would you like to add to that, Mr. Nuryanti? You've been a champion of...
So there is an interesting question, and I think somehow I observed, you know, based on what my students' response to the assignment, I'm not sure whether this was only happened in Indonesia or somewhere else, but I see that women architecture students or women architects pay attention more into the behavior studies rather than architectural expression per se. So, the psychological space in terms of digesting this psychological concept into the space rather than architectural expression, which is more usually physical expression and more like outdoor look rather than the interior. So I'm not sure whether this one is valid, but at least what I observe for my students' assignment, this is, you know, somehow it seems like consistent, this my observation. I don't know if this is too early to conclude. Thank you.
It's great. And Neha, would you like to add to that?
I think I will absolutely agree, like how Nandini said, the entire, being more empathetic comes naturally, maybe. And even when it comes to writing, I think that will obviously reflect. And since we're talking about bridging the gap between architecture and society, when you have not the built and not the design as the core of your writing work, and when you're talking about how and what it is doing to the society, so when that becomes the hero of your piece, automatically there is a more acceptance to it. And I think gender does or may be playing a role in it, not saying that men are not sensitive and not empathetic, but to some extent I think that definitely has a role in creating more empathy, or in expressing more empathy rather.
Thank you, all the three of you. I think this is something we need to continue, and maybe we have a Heritage Matters webinar particularly focusing on gender and writing architecture. A couple of comments from a professor of medicine, a medical practitioner who is a regular participant in our Heritage Matters webinars, says two things which are really important. One is, we should not hesitate from changing names. Historically, we've always changed names or places. But so what if it causes controversy, it causes debate, discussion, we start unraveling, doing history on the places. And I think that he encourages us to not hesitate. The second thing, I think I totally agree with him. So there's no discussion on this as a facilitator, I think. That so much of what is written is not accessible for people to read. And he, as a medical practitioner, would like to read a bit more about architecture that is accessible, for people who are not from the architectural profession. So I think that's one of the reasons why Neha is starting on a new journey in her life, and we all support her. And then there's one question which I just leave it for the panel to mull over. How is architecture connected to spirituality? The question is spirituality, not religion. There's a big difference between the two, although they interweave. But I want to come to the last question because we're running out of time. Is many scholars conduct research on community, but sometimes they treat the community as merely as an object. They take data, analyze, and make writing for publications. Sometimes there's no benefit for the local people. What do you think about it? I think it comes back to all the three of you. And Professor Nurianti, you talked about ethics. Nandini, the whole ethical practice. Neha is talking about ethics or community engagement. I'll leave it for all the three of you, because this is a malady not only here, but elsewhere in the world too. In Australia, we really have to specifically come up with policies and approaches, funding guidelines to make sure that this kind of knowledge extraction from, community groups, doesn't become exploitative. And I think that, policies are important, but I really like to, and I think our panelists would like to hear from all the three of you, what you think about this extraction of knowledge from community groups, extraction of knowledge from elders, but they're not necessarily written into our narrative. Anyone wants to go? Nandini, you can kickstart this because you emphasize ethics in your writings.
I think so. There are two parts to this conversation, and I think one is, the need for documentation is really the need of the hour, especially in India. And I know that we brought out another book about the traditional homes of Coorg in Karnataka, where we're from, because so many of them were being wiped out. And with that, the untangible, tangible, the history, the know-how, and the local history. So I think documentation and will help ensure that the correct credit and understanding of what has gone before is given to the right people. And I think that has to be done much more in India and in a much more structured fashion. And the second part is, of course, you know, as far as making sure this language gets communicated through writing, making sure that, you know, architects are respectful of what has gone before. And it's definitely an ethical issue. I think ethics has to span everything from respect of what has gone before to the manner in which architects work, to the community, to a government level. I think it has to be porous across all these aspects. And only then, you know, can a professional really rise up and, you know, fight for what is right. Because you can only have a voice if your ethics are clean. And I think often you can't fight for what is right if you're not doing the right thing. And that's why architects often fall silent, you know, and are not able to be heard. So the more of us that can work ethically and work across a system is the greater voice we will have.
Neha, would you like to join in? You know, how you could deal with this?
With a lot of our students, since we are in Ahmedabad and we have a very rich, you know, indigenous architecture here, we often go along with our students to document the pole houses of Ahmedabad and speak to the people, talk to them, take their photographs, have their stories written down or recorded. And even little things that the students that we've observed, they do, showing them the photographs that is clicked, or maybe getting them, a few of them have actually gotten back to the people, showing the drawings of their houses, maybe discussing the measure drawings that they do with the owners and with the residents of the houses. Even little like things like this kind of gives a sense of relief and you know, pride to the people who are being documented, who are being spoken to, who live in those areas. And these little things also have a huge role to play in making them inclusive of this entire part of documenting the architecture of that region.
Yeah, thanks, Neha. So fieldwork methods, community engagement, ethics of community engagement, these are some of the critical areas. And I think Nandini emphasized, you know, very much about importance of documentation. But the question always comes back. It's not only here in India, this is a global concern. As a UNESCO expert internationally, I can say that these concerns are international. But the question always remains, who owns whose heritage, who owns whose knowledge, who copyrights, you know, whose voice? I mean, these are critical issues that continue. Professor Nurianti, you're very, very conscious of these things. And as a minister, you were quite emphatic about the recognition of the diversity of communities and the ethics in community engagement. Would you like to add to this?
Yeah. It's so challenging in Indonesia, especially we are so much based on the oral tradition rather than written tradition. That's number one. And also when you talk about the community, for example, like when we managed to establish what we call like intangible cultural heritage board in order to have a select identify and then at the end contribute to the conservation of the or safeguarding of the intangible cultural heritage. We have to think about whether this politically correct in terms of, you know, whether this one is equally distributed. You know, we need to have one from the eastern part of Indonesia, one we need to have from the region that is probably politically fragile for Indonesia, for the nation. So all the political arena like that, it becomes one of the considerations this and which is not easy to deal with. So when we established the intangible culture heritage committee in the national level, both actually, one is a national a committee for the heritage, for the building heritage, and the other one is for intangible culture heritage. And both have to start with something, national level committee, who has to do the form of the lower level, like the provincial level. We have 34 provinces all over Indonesia. So this national level then become the umbrella, the main umbrella of the provincial levels. And then the provincial level has to be the umbrella of the district levels. So we have all over the country, we have more than 600 district level. So now, since 2011, this is when the first time it was established, until now, we and every district in Indonesia, we have this committee. So like three layers of the committee who is responsible to safeguarding all the intangible culture heritage. And the other committee is for the building heritage. So even though, you know, we have a very limited extract of knowledge, and sometime when we need some urgent or some important documents, we have to go and we have to find in the KITLV in Netherlands, you know, still well kept there. So all these things, we still have to find out how can we have access, or how can we sort of manage satelliting this center become one of our knowledge center of the heritage. So again, to face all the levels also at the same time, because it's centrally planned, everything is centrally managed, but at the same time you have to have like the decentralization issues, but then the heritage sometimes you caught in between all those levels of the policy making. So again, probably different country has faced different problem, but you can see that all this is not, you know, very easy, and it needs sometimes to really put everything on the table.
Professor Nurianti, everything you've said underlines one thing, that is policy, policy, policy. We need to have policy frameworks. And this is something not only in India, but in many parts of the world, it has become a challenge, and UNESCO has been advocating for, you know, policies in this, in diverse areas that you've referred to. Now, as we finish, I just want to get back to Neha's presentation, where she referred to IMPE. And this morning I was in a 1 hour long meeting with the mayor's office of Suzhou. You know, IMPE comes from, was born in Suzhou, comes from there. Some of his great work can be seen in Suzhou in China. I'm a technical advisor to the mayor's office in Suzhou and trying to formulate a research project with Anand National University. Hopefully some of the young people from Anand will be able to visit Suzhou in the near future. But the one thing that we were discussing this morning, which has come up as a question, is you know, not just how is architecture connected to spirituality, which is the question that's come up from one of our participants. How can we capture the spirit of the place, including the layers of significance, whether it's spiritual, cultural, social, economic, environmental, but in a holistic paradigm? Does the spiritual hold the glue? I mean, this was one of the things we were discussing this morning. So would each of you panelists very briefly, because we run out of time, address this question? How is architecture, what is the role of spirituality in architecture and architectural writing?
Well, if you take Indonesia as an example, as you know, that we live in the spiritual world. So successful architecture, it means that if you create a spirit in the architecture. So everything has not something to do with spirituality here. Even though you know, I'm sure you have like the feng shui of India, what you call it, like Vastu, I think, the Vastu. And the, you know, we have that in every layer. The lowest level of the community, we have that spirituality framework of mind. So, and where the orientation of the house, the door, the windows, all this roof, all this the shape of the roof, is everything is related to spirituality. The connection to the vertical connection, the connection with the our environment. You know, like in Bali, we have this Trihita Karana, which is the relation with the God, the relation with the environment, and the human relation. So all of this layer, all of this spiritual dimension has to be in the architecture works.
Thank you, Prof. Nuryanti. We talk about holistic approaches, but to put them into practice, both in teaching as well as practice, is a challenge. It needs rethinking. And Nandini, do you want to add to this?
I think really quick, I think as when we think of our childhood, there are certain spaces that come tunneling back into our minds. And why is that? And as architects, we're so blessed with the ability to build spaces that will contain memories forever. I mean, you walk into historic homes and they're telling you stories as you're walking through these spaces. And so there is spirit of spaces, there's no doubt. And we're fortunate to be able to create the physicality of those forms. When it comes to writing, I think, you know, words are powerful. To be able to convey that is possible. Possibly, you know, we've read so many beautiful interpretations of spaces, and there is poetry in that as well. So as they say, poetry in writing and poetry in space, it all amalgamates together.
Thanks, Nandini. The poetics of space, I forget the author's name. There's so much that's come out of Europe, and but also historically in many other parts of the world. And but you said that, you summed it up in words. It's what do we have, the diction, you know, to communicate? What kind of words? The crafting, word crafting, you know, is really critical in this, in the way we communicate. Neha, I'll leave the final comment with you. Over to you.
Yes, I would also agree that spirituality is ingrained in spaces. They have to have that quality, and for a human being to be able to feel the depth of it. If you want a person to feel scared, if you want them to feel lonely, if you want them to feel warm and you know, everything, all of that ultimately boils down to spirituality. And then even when we're discussing design studios with students, it is beyond the walls and the floor and the roof that they can make. We always want to push them, and we strive to get the quality of the space that, you know, the space that is required for the space. So achieving that quality becomes our prime discourse, and the dialogue that we create with the students is often that. So yes, architecture, spirituality, you can never really, you know, break that connection away.
Thanks, Neha. That's wonderful. And we had over 400 registrations, about 93 people actually real-time logged in. And there'll be thousands who will be listening to the recordings, the soundbite, and the will be uploaded within a few days, and the edited, because there's noise reduction that we have to look at. Video document will be on YouTube by hopefully within a week. So more people will be accessing this. One of the exciting things that I found out in the review process, talking to various people, is right from University of West Indies to Zagreb to different parts of the world, the Heritage Matters webinars are being used in tutorials for discussions in universities. And also people are listening to them in the Nordic countries. There's a very strong interest in the Nordic world and the Dutch area, Dutch Netherlands. So it goes global. I'd really appreciate all the three of you, the time that you're given. But I also appreciate Sharvari Mehta, who's made this. Hey, make yourself visible, Sharvari, you know, who, without whom I can't do these Heritage Matters webinars. and Vishal Bhaiya, you know, and his team, who actually helped us with the technical side. So all to everybody, I'm extremely grateful for having, you know, that we're able to establish this platform and will continue. So thank Deshi, thank Sharvari, and please give our best wishes to Vishal and who else is there with you, technical support?
Vishal,
okay, Vishal can hear. Vishal, can we see you once? Nobody has ever seen you in our Heritage Matters webinars. Can we just see you once, please? There's still quite a few people online. No, he's too shy. He's too shy. And but Professor Nuriantis, I know it's very late for you, but I'm really grateful. Hope that David was making you cups of tea and keeping you, you know, focused. And please give your wonderful family my best wishes. Nandini, I hope Brinda is listening and so are the other people, that you just, inspirational family. Your family is an institution for me, in my opinion. Thank you so much, not only from India, from the rest of the world, for the work that you and your mother and your family do. It's inspirational, it's much needed. Neha, we're in your hands. You're the next generation. So all of us, I mean, there are a lot of people are listening. A lot of people will be in touch. We're all together with you as you design your curricula and pedagogy to develop a master's in architectural journalism. All the best. Thank you so much to all the three of you. And it's a very, you know, it's wonderful. It's very emotional for me, especially to see Professor Nuriante, because I had such great honor of working with her on the first ever World Culture Forum that she organized with the President of Indonesia. At the opening, we had 1,326 performance artists from around the world. How they were choreographed with the opening ceremony is just phenomenal, you know, from all over the world. And the panels, you know, opening keynote speech by Professor Amartya Sen and Farid Zakaria from CNN, and you name it, so many people that you brought together for Sonoriante. It's you know, it was inspirational working with you. And I think you started a whole global discourse on culture and development. Until then, it was more rhetoric, but you actually, through case studies, showed the practice. Nandini, look, please don't forget to send us invitations to your next book, whether you write it, your mother writes it, whoever writes it. I have a collection here. And Neha, look forward to seeing you soon on campus and we'll work together.
Absolutely. And if I may, I would like to add to what Sky Morrison had to say.
Sure, sure.
Very interestingly, one of the studios that we are offering at Anant right now is actually on the same lines, taking the pandemic to our advantage, where the students are in their different states and different cities, and they are working on an architectural project, which is at their home place. And very interestingly, students have realized how much they did not know about their own cities. Because when they are in Ahmedabad studying and we take them all around the country for different sites and different projects, it is their own home place that they kind of automatically or tend to neglect, which is a realization that the pandemic has helped us do in one of the studios offered.
Thanks, Neha. That's thanks for finishing the webinar with those wonderful words. See, the next generation is one step ahead of us. Thank you. Thank you, everybody.